start with chanting, the same as yesterday, on page 8 or 18.
18, I think. Book you have. And after that, we also do the Buddhist Word on Loving Kindness on page 28 in one book. And I don't remember what the other book page is. But the Buddhist Word on Loving Kindness should be in the table of contents.
The great or the mighty, me. small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart, should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, mind upholding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
So this morning I gave various exercises. Hopefully you've been able to use them to some benefit, help to develop some more awareness with regard to the physical sensations, and say the variety of physical sensations, also to become a little bit more aware of the feeling tones which arise out of these sensations, pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Neutral, literally, technically, is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And of course, this is within the context of some degree of focused attention, calmness of mind. That is more than just an intellectual inquiry. We can actually have some direct experience, a variety of sensations that make up our experience of body. This is how we actually know this body, through sensations. We have, of course, behind that maybe a certain concept, idea, but that's usually subject to our own interpretations. The direct experience of body is through sensations, just as they are. And then the feeling tones, and perhaps you can recognize, I also added to this exploration, this inquiry, just to be able to notice if you can be aware of any particular response or reaction. If you do notice pleasant feeling tones, you notice any particular reaction in the body, in the mind, and most particularly the unpleasant feeling tones. This is where many of us have a certain degree of resistance, maybe even a blockage. Although, hopefully, this is only the first, just hardly a day, I guess, mainly about 24 hours of practice, so I assume the unpleasant feeling tones of the physical sensations are not too strong yet. Normally I save this for the third day, when people are groaning and they're beginning to notice their knees are beginning to shout to them. But this is the advanced group right here. But the real value of the meditation exercise is for us to have a direct experience. I mean, some of the theory is helpful, but really the direct experience is more beneficial. It is in the forest tradition, we actually talk about mindfulness and wisdom going together.
Should I shout louder or should I get the microphone? You're near the fan, so. Oh, I guess so. We'll try it out.
So how much didn't you hear? Should I start from the beginning again? No, okay. Direct experience of the sensations, feeling tones, and it is perfectly natural in a way that perhaps this is somewhat new to us. Maybe it's like learning a foreign language. That's what the exercises are designed to do, is to actually give us some more experience of this aspect of our experience. I mean, really, sensations are going on all the time, but how much are we aware of them? It's like the breathing is happening all the time, but how often are we aware of breathing? And likewise with feeling tones, they're there all the time. They're in the background of our experience. So this is not creating something new, it's just trying to be aware of what's already there. So that we get some more deeper understanding, deeper clarity with regard to what is happening in our experience as it is, the way things really are. And I think I left off somewhere with in the forest tradition, they talk about the mindfulness and wisdom going together. That is awareness and wisdom. I thought that wisdom was something you get from a book. That's the information. But the wisdom in the Buddha's teachings is direct experience, which comes out of clear seeing, out of awareness, mindfulness. When this quality is actually developed to a certain degree, maybe, you know, ideally to the degree of being a spiritual power, then we have some understanding, some wisdom arise too. And just like when you notice, for example, that there is some strong sensation in your body somewhere, well, then you have the wisdom to recognize, hey, is this dangerous or is this tolerable? Don't even notice it. Some people, they stretch their body or strain their body because they aren't aware that there is a strong sensation there. But when we actually notice it, then think about it. We can get to know, for example, our bodily limits. When some of these sensations, when there is some stress in the knees or the ankles, when you're sitting there cross-legged, how much is okay, how much is tolerable, or when does it get to the extreme limit of our endurance, or when it becomes maybe somewhat dangerous for our body, that we're going to do some major damage. We're going to have to, when we leave here, go to the physiotherapist on the way out. Wonder if they have one in Wiseman's Ferry. Might be a good business opportunity. And then to go back to this particular theme, going beyond suffering. I did mention that suffering is sort of a generic term. It covers quite a wide range of our experience. And maybe if it is too frightening, you can refer to the Buddhist word dukkha. And then you don't know what it means. And then you have to go to look in the Pali Dictionary and find out later. But if it does create some resistance in your mind, then just maybe use this a bit more neutral term, dukkha, then. But the way to access it in a, I would say, probably a less dramatic and less, a way which is less, we have less history about, is through the physical sensations, particularly through the sensations that give rise to unpleasant feeling tones. If you can notice something like these unpleasant feeling tones, does anybody notice a particular reaction to them, or response? unpleasant feeling tone? Anything special about it? Somebody, please nod. Do you notice a certain resistance? Do you notice a certain contraction in the body? A certain contraction in the mind? Unpleasant feeling tone, pain, discomfort, dis-ease. And if you can see this, you can actually touch into kind of a very primal or fundamental contraction of our being, bodily and mentally too. It's quite normal. When there is pain there, the body contracts. You can notice, you can feel the muscles tensing up and contracting. And then if you can follow that, if you can keep your attention on it and not get spun off into the stories about it and all the worry and fear about it, perhaps you can see what happens with that when the body contracts. More unpleasant feeling tone. You'll find yourself getting caught in kind of a whole syndrome now. The contraction around the pain, and then when it contracts, it feels more painful, more contraction, more pain, more contraction. Ouch. Otherwise, sometimes we just get spun off into our mind and we start thinking about it and worrying about it. But this is a very, very kind of fundamental or even primal reaction in the body. You can see this in the mind too. I mean, how much can we tolerate unpleasant, say, a physical sensation? Is that very strong? How about, I'll refer more... At this stage in the practice, I would say it's helpful, more helpful, to stay with the physical sensations because they're very simple, more tangible, very simple, and you can say maybe they're. I would even say they're more honest too. I find my body is very is much more honest than my mind. If I notice some suffering in the mind, and I go off into my stories and my explanations and my reasons for it and all the rest of it, but. There's a physical sensation, quite simple. You know, in a way, the body's quite dumb, which is probably a good thing sometimes. My mind can be too clever to figure it all out. But if you can notice that contraction, at least with regard, say, to the physical sensations, you begin to understand something about the whole process of suffering. We suffer because of the contraction. If you can maybe, if your mind is somewhat calm and you have a close relationship with your point of reference, you can go back to the breathing. You could even say breathe into it and perhaps step outside that contractive activity. You can have a different relationship to it. And maybe it's helpful to be supported by some calmness of mind, but there's also other practices which can be helpful. If you notice there's a contraction and you can see how it can build up and you can get caught in that kind of syndrome about it, contraction and pain and contraction and pain, and maybe you can, with that wisdom, you can just kind of step away from it a bit, step out of it. Another helpful supportive meditation exercise is the practice of friendliness or metta. In this recitation we did, it's about the Buddhist words of loving kindness on metta. And it gives a more general way of relating to this attitude, but how we can use it practically. When you notice something which is unpleasant, for example, most people, when there is some unpleasant feeling tone, they usually turn it into something we would call an enemy, or something to fight with. And the practice of friendliness is very helpful to direct towards something we call an enemy, or something we relate to as an enemy, something we fight with. You don't need to be friendly to pleasant feeling, do you? We all love pleasant feeling, right? If you notice pleasant feeling tone, wow. I've been waiting for it all this time. I very eagerly embrace that. But the unpleasant, you notice you're pushing it away. You're relating to it as an enemy, something to avoid, something to fight with. So we can change our attitude and be a little bit more friendly to it. And this practice of friendliness It doesn't mean we love it. I mean, sometimes it's translated as loving kindness, which I find a little bit too idealistic. I mean, I really don't love my pain. Yeah. But if I'm sitting here and I still got another 15 minutes to sit here cross-legged and impress people, then it could be helpful to have a little bit more of a friendly relationship to it rather than fight with it. So if I just a bit more receptive, a bit more open to it, a bit more friendly to it, it changes. What we're doing is stepping away from this normal attitude of contraction. And if you can actually apply it, relax into it's a strong sensation, it's an unpleasant feeling tone. That's all it is. And especially if you've been observing the feeling tones with some continuity, you begin to recognize just how changeable they are. Feeling, can you actually show it to us? Can you actually hold it up? I mean, at least sensations are reasonably tangible, but a feeling tone, let's see. I see quite a few floating around in the room here. They just don't settle anywhere. If you begin to observe this feeling tone, which is there all the time, you see how ephemeral it really is. Now it's pleasant, and it can start off as pleasant and change to neutral and unpleasant and back and forth thousands of times in the course of just a few moments even. So when we really see it as it is, we get a different relationship to it. Normally, the feeling tones are kind of fundamental to our whole motivation in life. But if we actually see how fragile they really are, how insubstantial they really are, we've been building our life upon sand, you know, rather than building all these fantasies about it. You know, I come to meditation in order to experience bliss, and that's my motivation, drives me here. But you begin to notice, you know, how ephemeral bliss is. It's blissful because it is ephemeral, actually. I mean, it's not my real experience, but I mean, I'm sure if you had eternal bliss, it'd be terribly boring after a while, you know. Because it's so fleeting, when it does come, wow, you really enjoy it. But if you had bliss all the time, it'll probably be a bit boring and even unpleasant after a while, maybe. Think, oh, not that bliss again. <You know? laughs> There was somebody who came on a retreat in, I think it was in Germany or somewhere, and at the question time, he said, I have this problem in meditation, he said. The problem is joy. I said, a problem? He said, yes. He said, well, when he was learning meditation, he had read some book, and it had said that the purpose of meditation was to have joy all the time. So after a little while, being quite a determined individual, after a little while of practice, I don't know, weeks or months or something, he didn't say, but he got into the joy. And every time he sat, it was just joy, joy, joy. But then he realized, hey, this is getting a bit boring, actually. It's just joy all the time, I mean. And then it became a bit of a hindrance. You know, I think he recognized that spiritual practice is really a developmental process. And if this joy was here all the time, he's not developing. And then he reflected a bit more and realized that actually this joy was something he'd created. It wasn't something which actually was part of the unfolding of freedom or liberation of mind. It was something he created. Okay? Which, I mean, well, it's a pretty good creation anyway. Probably better than some people can do, but he realized it was artificial, really. Okay? Well, unfortunately, joy is not my problem, so I was a bit hard-pressed to answer him. But if I just pointed out this, with all these phenomena, if you notice it more clearly, you see how impermanent it really is. You know, if you look more closely at these phenomena, there is a beginning and an end. It does arise, it does pass away. I mean, sometimes it seems to persist because of our insistence upon it or our attachment to it. But there is a beginning of it, and there is an end to it too. But we have usually have a little bit of resistance, even sometimes quite a bit of resistance, to observing the unpleasant feeling tones. But this is actually a very common phenomena. This is an aspect of life which we come across all the time. So, you know, rather than keep running away from it, it may be helpful to actually study it and investigate it. And this is really what the Buddha is trying to tell us, the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. You know, what I would call a worldly attitude is somebody who's just constantly running away from the unpleasant. And you can try your whole life, but you still have to die, still get old, still get sick sometimes. So there's no end to it. You can keep running forever. But a Buddha realized a different kind of experience. He realized that if you can stop and look at it, you see something different. Because so much of what we interpret as suffering is really just compounded by our own ego, by our own self. You know, we build all these stories around it, and we don't really actually see how it really is. When you begin to notice, for example, these feeling tones, you begin to recognize just how fragile, how ephemeral they really are. Yeah, and then just from that understanding, our reactiveness around the unpleasant begins to kind of fade a little bit. So you can actually begin to look at it a little bit more deeply, a little bit more closely. And if you, we also have to recognize our own limitations. I mean, hopefully this is based upon our direct experience and not getting too idealistic about it. But, oh yes, this weekend I'm going to overcome suffering completely. The going beyond suffering means ultimately that only the fully enlightened being goes beyond suffering completely. So it's okay, you know, if we aren't successful this weekend, you know. Don't criticize yourself, you know, it's quite normal. Probably. Maybe you get a little bit of insight into it, but you know, we don't want to get work on it too incessantly or too obsessively, because once we learn the principle, we try and apply this now to all of our experiences. And for example, we can, in this situation, we can get some direct experience with regard to the unpleasant feeling tones. You can see just that our reaction to it, the contractions building up, and then you recognize, okay, maybe it's helpful to step out of it. Even if you just remove your attention to the breathing sensation, natural breathing, give a bit more space, come back to it, you can interrupt this old habit pattern. And then if you do find something which is a little bit more challenging, this practice of friendliness can be very, very helpful. This allows us to, at the very least, you know, if friendliness is too grand, at the very least, just not contend with it, not fight with it, not resist it. The non-resistance in the beginning. And we can do this practically by relaxing into that contraction, relaxing into that resistance, breathe into it, learn to be a bit more receptive to it. If you're developing more awareness, awareness quality gets more sharper and stronger, then what it shows us, it exposes some of these fundamental experiences we have. And with that awareness, there is an honesty with it. Yes, there is some unpleasant feeling tone there. We can't just go into our denial about it anymore. So that awareness is telling us, yes, there is this unpleasant feeling tone. Now look how we react to it. Are we resisting it? Are we getting frightened by it? Yeah. Just go back to the breathing again to disengage from those old habitual reactions to it. We can come back to it and see it in a different way. We can actually have a different relationship to these experiences which we normally are running away from. Of course, we have to apply this, you know, you can say, applying this principle in a wide variety of experiences. I mean, being able to see it once can be very encouraging, especially something, you know, something like physical pain. We have to be a little bit sensitive, because physical pain is showing us that there is some resistance, there is some stress in the body, so got to be a little bit careful. However, you know, pain, the decision that pain and also feeling tones, this is in the mind. So So if we change our attitude of mind, we can change our relationship to it. For example, I mean, we probably, all of you have had the experience, if you're had a very good day at work and you're feeling in a good mood, maybe you're driving home from work and somebody cuts you off or something, or you probably can just pass it off, huh? No big deal, because you're in a good mood. Yeah. But if you're in an irritable mood, a little bit edgy, a little bit nervous, and somebody does the same thing, you might notice a different reaction, huh? You get really annoyed with that person. They suddenly become a monster, you know, because of your mood. Yeah. They maybe done exactly the same thing, but we interpret it through our mood quite differently. Yeah. So if we have some experience of calmness of mind, for example, it can create a more expansive mood in the mind. You can maybe even experience some degree of peacefulness, a more well-being in our mind. If you bring up this awareness of unpleasant feeling tone, for example, you see it quite differently. I mean, hopefully not so bad that you begin to enjoy it, you know, but we have a different relationship to it. So it's like shifting our usual habitual patterns now. And if we begin to open to it in a more relaxed way, a more peaceful way, then, hey, why am I reacting so strongly to it all the time? And maybe sometimes just that relaxation can shift our whole experience of it. And what before was seemingly unpleasant, and we could build stories about it and all kinds of negativity around it, just kind of dissolves because we shift our attitude. You know, some of the unpleasant sensations in the body, if you can relax of them. You know, I had experiences in Thailand. You know, we had quite a few mosquitoes in Thailand, and they can be terribly annoying. You know, especially when it's my blood they're taking. You know, but sometimes when I had a reasonably calm state of mind, I could just sit with it and watch, and not react to it, and I noticed that when I could do that, it didn't itch. It was when I got really irritated and got a little bit disturbed by it, it itched for days. Somebody else, I read a story about somebody who they had read actually from the yoga tradition, about somebody had told them about just the development of the practice of just awareness with what's happening to us, especially unpleasant experiences. And just after they heard about this, they were closing the window, and they closed the window on their finger. And their normal reaction was to jump around and scream and swear, probably. She didn't say that, but probably so. But she remembered what this teacher had said, so she just stopped, sat down, and just observed. It went into this sensation, and the unpleasant feeling tone with it. And she could, it wasn't so easy, but she had, because of the faith in this teacher and belief in his teaching, she could do that. And she just would sit there quietly and observe this throbbing finger. And then she noticed her state of mind too. She noticed how she was feeling sorry for herself, and she was feeling a bit self-defeated. Yeah. And she could just observe all these moods coming up. And gradually, her experience was that the pain went away much quicker than if she screamed at it and shouted and danced around. And she learned about herself, some of these moods that she gets caught in. And she said the next day, her finger was healed up much quicker. I haven't tried that one yet. I mean, it's a bit premeditated, I think, to close a window, but but I have noticed it with regard to moods, for example. I mean, I'm talking at this stage just about physical sensations because they're a lot easier to deal with. But we can apply the same principle to all experiences we would classify under dukkha, unpleasant feeling tones, moods that give rise to unpleasant feeling tones, but much easier to look at the sensations because they actually have a much more tangible point of reference then. But we can open our attitude to it, be a little bit more aware, a little bit more settled with it. We can actually change our relationship. And this is the key to going beyond suffering. Okay, you know, The strong sensation still there, the unpleasant feeling tone is still there, but it's not compounded. It's not increased by all of our emotional baggage we add to it. You know, it shouldn't be this way. You know, I shouldn't feel pain. You know, what did I do to deserve this? It just is a feeling tone, just is a sensation. Simple as that. And many times my experience is that it's all this compounding, all this extra baggage, emotional baggage, and even the physical ones, the contraction around it, that is actually more painful, more unpleasant than the initial experience. Sometimes there is these, let's say, a physical sensation, and if you can follow it, maybe you notice how you're way down the line. And what was a little bang, you bang your knee or something, or you cut your finger, and before you know it, you're back when you're a little child and your mother's scolding you, and you're, wow, what happened? It's just a little cut. And of course, when you're a little child and you cut your finger, it's really painful, you know. But now you're a mature adult, it shouldn't be so painful. But then we added all this emotional baggage to it, it's doubly painful. But if we can actually change your attitude, this is a fundamental way to open and access this whole area of suffering in our life. And if we notice, first of all, that we're observing the sensations and the feeling tones, we begin to see just how changeable they are. Sometimes some of these experiences, you know, they only happen for a very slight moment, but our story goes on for days, hours and days. But if you actually go back to that experience as it is, it's already changed. We're left with these stories, kind of high and dry, actually, about it. But if you go back to the experience, you know it's changeable, it's changing. It's not going to be long-lasting, it's not going to be there forever. And just being more aware of impermanence and change kind of helps us to get into the flow of it a bit more, the processive nature of it. Normally, when there is a contraction, what we're doing is turning it into a fixed, solid object. Yeah. And then, of course, then when there's an object, there's a subject right there. There's the self, the ego there. You know, I feel pain. Before, there was just a feeling tone, a more objective feeling tone, which was part of the human experience. And then if it reaches a certain limit, then, ooh, that hurts. And we objectify it. And then, I am feeling pain now. I come into it. And that's where the real suffering is. I mentioned yesterday two kinds of suffering. There is the kind of basic one, just of having a human body and a human mind. We have our disappointments, we have our physical sensations, we have our feeling tones. And then there is all the extra stuff we add to it. All the extra stuff is basically the self and the ego. That's all extra to it. There are those particular experiences of body and mind. And then the ego comes into it, the self comes into it, and creates complications around it. And most of that is really what we can really call suffering in the widest sense of the term. But it's all extra. We're adding it to ourselves. We're creating that ourselves. There still is physical sensations and feeling tones, but all the stories, all the references to myself and the history and all that is all extra. It isn't necessary. You can put it down. You can disengage from it. If you can see the whole process and how we get caught in it. Unfortunately, so much of it is just habitual, and it's just a reactive syndrome conditioned by these processes over a long period of time. Well, it's, you know, we can see that. Maybe not so easy to slow it down. But at least if we see it, we can bring some awareness to it. We don't compound it, increase it, and keep up the momentum of it anyway. And then slowly, maybe it begins to dissolve. The other part of suffering in a more general sense, is that sometimes the experiences that we become aware of are only part of the bigger picture. You know, for example, if you're aware of some strong sensation in your body, you know, maybe you notice some heaviness in your heart, for example. Yeah. Well, maybe it is just because, you know, you had too much breakfast or something, or too much lunch, you know, and you got a bit of gas in your stomach. But if it persists, you know, for hours or days, if it persists, maybe it's only, as it were, like the tip of the iceberg. It's only the outward symptoms of something a bit deeper. But at least being aware of that sensation gives an opening now to try and go into it. And you can apply the same process. Try to relax into it, try to open to it, be more friendly to it. And it begins to unravel, begins to open up. And perhaps you can begin to unpack it. You know, this is a ongoing process. We're still applying and still using the same practice technique, the same practice principles, but to open up to deeper levels of some of this hurt or this suffering, if you like, in the widest sense of the term. Because most of us have been running away from it, we usually have a backlog. Yeah. So when we come to spiritual practice and develop a little bit more awareness and some of these tools, and we begin to start unpacking it to some degree. But generally it requires that we keep up with the practice. As I mentioned yesterday, it's a way of life, not just a technique or a quick fix result. Sometimes it's helpful to keep up with it, so we begin to go deeper into the different levels of suffering which in our being. Ultimately it goes back to the whole foundation, the whole source of the self. In the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha talked about there is suffering, there is unpleasant experiences, but that there's a cause to it too. They aren't ultimate reality, there's a cause there, they're just conditioned. So, but in order to find the cause, we need to go to that condition and then explore it deeper. I had a reasonably vivid experience of this myself some years ago. Hopefully people haven't heard this before. This is an old story, but it's a new audience, right? So I can... This was many years ago when I was in Switzerland. And it was in the middle of our three-month monastic retreat in the wintertime. And it was right in the middle of this retreat. We had one of these heavy snowfall, and the next day was one of these spectacular sunny days, you know, a picture postcard in the Alps, the Swiss Alps. So I thought, I got to go out and get a picture of this. And the only way to walk through the snow was actually to walk on the ski track, which went in front of the monastery. But there is a rule that we shouldn't walk on the ski track, you see. Ski tracks are for skiers, not for walkers. You know? I knew this, but nobody's around. It'll only take me 5 minutes, you know, and just walk over there to get a picture and come back. So I walked across the ski track, a couple of hundred meters to try and get a good picture, and guess what? Ski patrol comes along. Skis right up to me and says, "Das ist verboten." Looking on the ski track, he said, yeah, I know this, I'm just taking a picture. No, get off the ski track. Well, I tried to walk off the ski track, and the snow was half a meter deep, you know. So when I walked back and got back to my room to continue with my retreat, and there was this unpleasant feeling in my heart, you know, just a little irritation, you know. This man was not being very polite to me, you know, a monk, you know. And I wasn't really doing anything wrong. I mean, well, okay, a little bit. But I mean, I live there, you know, so I can make a few exceptions for me, but he didn't. So anyway, the first day, a little bit of annoyance, irritation. I thought it was irritation, so okay. So back to the breathing, and then next day, gee, it's still there. Wait a minute. This is going to interrupt my meditation retreat. So I looked at it again, and it's still there. My goodness, 3 days, this is getting serious. You know, and the guy had already skied away, so I couldn't work out, we couldn't work out a relationship anymore. So I'm left with it. So the third day, fourth day, still there. Gee, this is getting serious. I still got another month and a half of meditation retreat to go. It's not very peaceful having this irritation there. So So then I remembered my instructions to everybody else. Well, maybe you should look at it and be more friendly to it. So I looked in my heart and I tried to be a bit more friendly and open and receptive. It wasn't very pleasant, but at least it was a reasonable, obvious point of reference right here in the chest. And so I observe that and go into it and try and be a bit more patient and a bit more friendly. And after, I don't know, a few days or a week or so, it suddenly shifted. And it wasn't irritation at all. It was resentment. Ooh, a long story with that one. Suddenly the stories of my life, all through the rest of my life, began to come up. My goodness. Resentment, resentment, resentment. And anyway, looked at that. That was interesting to know that. And so I could try and be more friendly and more receptive and open to that. And another week passed, and that shifted. It wasn't resentment at all. It was frustration. Oh, even a longer story with that one. So I patiently tried to be more friendly and open and receptive, and then that began to shift. And then the fear came up. And then when the fear comes up, I know I'm getting close to home, because to me, fear is the most primal reaction. This is when you're getting close to the ego. The ego is its first line of a defense is fear. So I got open to that. That took a lot more openness and friendliness. And there's several kinds of fear there. I mean, I had to peel back the layers, and gradually, after another few weeks, that began to shift. And when the fear went away, there was just a clear, colorless, pulsing energy there, right in the heart. No more, and in the process too, the sense of the owner of all this stuff began to get more and more, kind of more dissipated. It was less dense, it was less solid. So finally, the fear gradually began to fade away, dissolve away, and just this clear, pulsing energy was there. There was no reference. It was hardly a very, very subliminal reference to anybody owning it. And if I did go back to owning it or trying to identify with it, the fear came back again. So don't go there. just stay with that clear pulsing energy. And it was very incredibly peaceful. The mind was very, very peaceful, but it was a little bit puzzling too. You know, what is this? There was no color to it. There was no form to it. It was just a pulsing energy, vibrating energy there. I could be at peace with that and just sit with that for a week or so, and it began to fade away finally. And then I began to think, what is that anyway? And I still don't know what it was, but it was peaceful anyway. But the real lesson in that was that what I was first aware of, this irritation, was just one symptom of something much deeper. And just applying this practice of opening to it, being receptive to it, exploring it in its various nuances. I mean, there were storylines about each part of it. There was self-reference, there was memories with it. But not getting hung up on any of them. Just trying to open to it and try to observe them as they unfolded. And gradually, different layers began to unpack. I explain it as just unpacking these particular experiences. And at the core of it, there is peace. We actually, our nature is peace. And then the sense of self comes into it. In reference to a sense of self, there's fear. And then all the rest of it starts to build up on it. We each have our own personal reactive syndromes, how we've actually manifested the sense of self. And mind followed this path of, fear and frustration and resentment. And maybe somebody else follows a path of joy and bliss. I don't know, but we each have our own path to follow. But what was important to recognize was that irritation was not the real issue. It's just a symptom of some ongoing process. And a similar process, self-identification and the holding on to it and identifying with it and then building more stories around it. And through the course of life, you know, we relate to different situations with the same template, you know, the same kind of patterns. But they get played out, usually in a little bit more complex, more refined, civilized, you know, way, mature way, something or other. You know, the irritation was a little bit more evolved than the primal fear, you know, and the frustration, maybe the childhood frustration. But it really, it was all part and parcel of the same thing, this ego identification. So just being able to see all that, how we actually compound and make our own suffering, really, we can take some responsibility for it. Otherwise, you know, normally, you know, it's hard to handle, and so we start dumping it on other people, we start blaming other things outside for it. It's all our own concoctions, actually. A bit hard to swallow, isn't it? Making our own suffering. Okay. But, I mean, it's also very enriching, because that's what makes the diversity of life, too. We have our own, each one of us has our own diversity of ways that we actually experience suffering. And instead of seeing it as a great tragedy, you know, we can actually turn it around. It can become a very valuable lesson, because if there is suffering, there is contraction around the ego. So this is a way into the ego. And if we just do it kind of philosophically, it's very complicated. You end up even making more complicated ego out of it, trying to explain yourself. But if you're aware of some degree of suffering, there is a very, very primal, a very coarse expression of ego then. So if you recognize that, you can try and be a bit more friendly to it. It is part of you. It is actually part of you, which you try to run away from and deny. So you can try and befriend it now, rather than try and fight with it or conquer it and create more conflict in your life. And that conflict is the suffering. It's the compounded suffering now. When you can learn to re-own this, befriend it, you can begin to actually move through it. And you learn about different dimensions of yourself. Not only do you learn about it, but you can actually re-own it. A lot of this stuff is actually split off energy. You know, anger, frustration, resentment, if your life force is going into that, you know, going to these negative things, you're burning up your energy, burning up your life force. And now if you can learn to befriend it, you can transform it now. Transmute it into a more skillful part of your being now, into wisdom and understanding. You can work with it in a more skillful way now. Sound reasonable?
Yeah.
If not idealistic, at least reasonable. But at least if, you know, just to become more aware of the physical sensations and these feeling tones, especially the unpleasant ones, that's the way to open up to it, open into it, because that's where we have our resistance and our contraction then. If you can actually see that process and see what it's doing to you. How does it feel to be contracted? Yuck. But when you feel it, and you really, really can experience that, then you learn letting go. Yeah. People have heard maybe about letting go, and it sounds like a very wonderful thing, but the real letting go comes as a result of the practice. You know, Ajahn Chah gave the example, you know, to be able to let go, you've got to pick it up first. You pick up something before you put it down. Most of us would prefer to sit up in our brain and just say, oh yes, nice, nice, but let go, let go. You don't really let it go. You're still holding on to it. It's just a concept in your brain then. But with mindfulness, with collectedness and mindfulness, we pick these up, pick these experiences up. And when you really sense how heavy they are, how heavy that contraction is, anybody with any wisdom will let it go. But it comes out of the result of seeing that weight then, that contraction, and then you begin to open up. If we try and do it kind of as a way with the, try to do it with the ego, you just create another form of ego, spiritual ego now, that's now, you know, letting go too. You know? And it's just, you're just playing into the same game again, the same ego game, but when you actually see that weight of the contraction, let it go, the ego itself, you're letting go of the ego, of the self then. You're stepping outside all the games it plays, and all of its old habit tendencies. So it's unraveled then. And this is the way that we can really go beyond suffering then, because this extra suffering is the byproduct of the ego, of the self. Any other way is just playing into the ego's game, and it's going to be compounded. Maybe it can seem that it's gone, but usually it's just transformed into another form. Just like the, you know, my fear was transformed into frustration, and the frustration transformed into resentment and irritation. And, you know, but if you actually see it in its very simple form, very easy to deal with then. It's a matter of just applying this practice, you know, in the variety of expressions of it. And the deeper we can go into it, the more we go beyond it, the more we see through it. So if you continue with the practice, just continuing being more aware, clearly aware of, say, the unpleasant feeling tones and our reaction to it and that contraction. Most people think when they notice the unpleasant feeling tones, they want to get away from it. It's totally the opposite way of practice. You have to go into it, go to it. But now with collectedness of mind and clarity, friendliness, supported by friendliness, and we have a totally different relationship to it. And what before was seemingly, you know, a kind of unbearable suffering, you know, we just see right through it. All it is a sensation and a feeling tone and a state of mind that arises and passes away, and there's no substance to it. But we have to keep applying this and see it directly for ourselves. It's our own personal experience then. So I think I should pause there, because I see there's a whole basket of questions here, which I... it's already 9 o'clock. Are you fading? Depends how interesting the questions are. I just take the top one. Oh, my goodness. This might be a long topic too. Can you tell us about sukha? You know, this is the opposite of dukkha. I mentioned dukkha, translated as suffering. What about sukha? And secondly, the middle way, equanimity. Let's see. How many hours you got? Well, the word sukha is probably most prominently used when the Buddha said that Nibbana is the ultimate sukha, the ultimate well-being. And that the, you know, this is a different, I wouldn't translate it as happiness, you know. Sometimes dukkha is translated as suffering and sukha as happiness. But this is actually a different dimension then of happiness or well-being. Because many times happiness, in a practical sense, usually happiness is just kind of a superficial way of avoiding suffering. The American Constitution, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. See, and they're always pursuing happiness because it keeps running away. But well-being is something different. Well-being is like it's like our innate nature to be well. But if we can, we need to be able to contact it, though. For example, you bring attention to the breathing. Do you notice? Can you notice the feeling tone with the breathing? Isn't it generally more neutral? It's not really exciting. It's not really depressing. It's more neutral. But if this is closer to equanimity, then the neutral feeling tone. Equanimity is also a very, very advanced state. Because this is being even-minded with the whole range of experience, sukha and dukkha. Many people, they idealize equanimity as the ultimate aim of practice. And they say, okay, I have to be even-minded. But then you end up being indifferent. Yeah. If you haven't tuned in to pleasant feeling and unpleasant feeling tone, The only way to be even-minded is to tune out, be indifferent to them. So equanimity also is like a result of the practice, I would say. You find that if you actually tune into the pleasant feeling tones and unpleasant feeling tones, you get to see them how they are, that they are not really very substantial, always changing. You have a bit more of you aren't so fascinated, you aren't so entranced by them anymore. And your mind inclines more towards an even-mindedness then. You aren't jumping on the happiness and running away from the unhappiness, because recognize, you know, it's like a false ride, actually. You know, because they don't really have any substance to them. You know, when you think you're on a happy feeling tone, pleasant feeling tone, gee, you can just shift like that without any control over it. And you think you're being overwhelmed by unpleasant feeling tones, they can shift so quickly. Yeah. They have no real substance to them. So then you kind of back off a bit. You get a bit disenchanted with the roller coaster ride and a bit more even-minded about it. In another sense, reference to a topic of joy and spiritual practice, this is a different kind of sukha, or pleasant feeling tone, if you like, joy. It's actually a translation of the word piti, which is rapture or ecstasy or elation. This is one of the factors of awakening, which is actually comes out of a deeper practice of concentration, meditation. And you can experience moments of ecstasy or bliss. These also are conditioned. They're just conditioned experiences. So not to be made too much of, although the Buddha recognized that when there is these very positive experiences and emotions, I mean, it does open the heart. It does give you a bit more of a spaciousness in your practice, in your mind. You know, if we're always observing suffering, investigating suffering, maybe it gets a little bit tense sometimes, you know. You're going to need a holiday sometime in joy. So it's not all suffering. You know, suffering is more like the theme of the topic. And then the moments of joy come along the way when we're developing more concentration, more clarity of mind. They're also part of the bigger picture. I hope that's enough for now. I've got a few more to. I don't know if I do all of them right now. Do I have to do all of them?
No, you do it tomorrow. We'll cover the top.
Okay. So there's a question here about after a stroke or severe head injury, the brain may change, so the physical functioning is okay, but the personality and mental qualities are different. I understand Venerable Ajahn Chah suffered from such change. I'm curious about how that affected him, his character, etc. I wasn't actually around when Ajahn Chah was bedridden and he was immobile, but generally speaking, when Ajahn Chah did suffer any physical discomfort, I mean, he had malaria for 3 years, which also affects you, not only your physical body but your mind, your brain. And somebody who was with him at the time said that he could be just shivering with the chills, with malaria, and then somebody came in to see him and he'd just stop. And he had enough control over his mind and body that he could just appear normal. People hardly even noticed. And another time, there was a situation where a monk in Ubon province, where the monastery was, he was a meditation monk, but then the monastery got taken over by the expanding town, and he became a village monastery, a town monastery. But when he had some young monks come to his monastery who had interest in meditation, he took them to Wat Nana Chat, the international monastery, as it was still out in the country in quite a quiet place for meditation. After a few years, this monk, this abbot monk who brought his disciples there, he was bitten by a rabid dog. and he got rabies. You know what happens when you get rabies? You go stark raving mad. And all they could do was just chain him to a post. And he was like, he'd gone totally berserk. And Ajahn Chakro, who was the abbot of Wat Nanachat, had known this monk, and he went to Ajahn Chah and he asked him, and he said, "This monk's been meditating for 40 years, and then this dog bites him, and he gets this disease, and now he's totally changed. Has all his meditation been a waste of time?" And Ajahn Chah said, "Not necessarily. Because if your meditation goes deep enough, then some fundamental deep levels of our mind are touched by it and changed by it. So maybe on the surface, he appears that he's totally crazy, but underneath, nothing is moving. Nothing has been affected by it. So it's very hard to tell. You know, we're limited by just what we can read and even interpret sometimes by people's outward expressions. You know, like some people who have been in a coma, for example, and everybody thinks that they're a vegetable, and you know, maybe they treat them quite disrespectfully. And if they come out of the coma, they say, "I heard you," because they still have hearing. You know, they look, they don't express any emotion or like they can understand anything. And people had said that with Ajahn Chah too, when he was apparently in these deep states of inactivity and seemingly in a coma. They said that when they could talk to him, because he still has his ears open, and there was some recognition, they said. Sometimes, you know, his eyes would move or even blink or something. And they felt that he could understand them, that he had some communication there. So it's very hard to say, actually. So be careful how you judge people or interpret people. You know, they still maybe have some level of consciousness. And the Buddha's teachings, we say that as long as there is breathing, as long as there is life process, there's consciousness. Maybe it's not the consciousness we can recognize. You know, it's not self-consciousness, or we can talk to you, but there is some kind of consciousness there. So, and people are still have some degree of knowing. Consciousness is some degree of knowing. So somebody's asking about they bow to the Buddha many times, and one day when they were bowing, they recognize a different quality of the bowing. It seems to be some kind of almost like magic or something, or some power coming out of it. Seems that it's not themselves who are bowing. And I would like it to happen again. With your, can I explain and give me some advice? Well, I think all these activities, like the rituals, for example, and ceremonies, they can be looked upon as a kind of meditation as well. And sometimes people use like the active meditations of bowing or chanting, and they can get very energized by it, especially when they can get bring in a sense of faith, an attitude of faith or devotion. They can get very deep concentration. And this sounds like this is what happened. The mind became very concentrated in that act of devotional bowing. Sometimes we just think that meditation or concentration is developed by focusing on breathing. But any activity we can do, it can become a vehicle or a focus for the mind becoming very centered or very focused. It can have concentration. I know, for example, when I was in Switzerland, we were in the mountains, and some days we had a day to go walking in the mountains. And because some of the paths were even very dangerous, you had to be very, very mindful, not only of where you're walking, because a false step, you could slip down the mountain. Well, when you're in the mountains, you also have to be aware of the weather changes. And sometimes I got more concentration out there walking in the mountains than I did sitting on my cushion. And then, of course, there is the experience that some people have where they're Say they're up in the mountains walking somewhere, and they come around a corner, and they see this spectacular view, and they have some really, really eureka experience. Like, oh my goodness, I think it's a fantastic view. Very likely it was just a very, very deep concentration experience. They kind of lost themselves in the view. They stepped outside their own self-reference, and they just got absorbed. They got really absorbed in this spectacular view because it was so surprising and so spectacular. And then they think, it's the view. Get out the camera. Get a picture of this. You know, they don't know that it was their mind that did it. And this was the spectacular view or the surprise experience was just a trigger, a catalyst for their mind coming together in deep concentration, absorption. And for a moment they forget themselves and they think, wow, Switzerland is a spectacular country. Yeah. Then they come back next year to relive it and they bring their memories with them and it doesn't happen again. It was due to the spontaneity of it and the immediacy of it. They just got absorbed into that view. This is all just an activity of mind. It's a condition of mind, a phenomenon of mind, actually. It can happen to any of us, anytime. So watch out. If you know that, then you just recognize this is a quality of concentration, absorption, and you don't get frightened by it, you don't get confused by it. Just a phenomenon of mind, then. Somebody, when they sit meditation, they smell their favorite food. Not the best question to answer tonight at night, late at night, when we haven't been eating. The smell gets stronger and stronger, and they lose their mindfulness of the breath because the smell is too much. What suggestion and advice can you give? Well, if you can just recognize that it's only another sensory stimulation. It's just smell, there's sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. These are just various stimulations. You know, they just arise, they pass away. You know, maybe there is some very strong attraction because it is your favorite food. You know, but you just recognize that it is just a passing phenomena, a passing sense impression. I know I had the same problem myself when I was in Thailand in the early days of practice. And you know, especially in the monastery, not having supper in the evening. And I remember one day walking meditation, at the end of the walking path was a giant hamburger waiting for me to eat me. It was going to eat me rather than me. It. But actually, it was so absurd, I just could laugh at it. It was so ridiculous, you know. And then I didn't kind of encourage it, right? I wasn't so fascinated by it anymore. It's so ridiculous, you know. So hopefully, if you can just be more aware of it and not get too excited about it or too concerned about it, you get a bit more objective perspective on it, don't make it so personal a problem, then maybe after a while it begins to lose its pull upon you or its attraction to you then. I'm going along here. Am I answering it clearly, succinct enough or... detail enough? Yeah. During breath meditation, if one can feel as if one is falling or descending to a lower level, what should one do? I mean, when we, say, withdraw our senses from the external world and focus on an internal experience, for example, sometimes we get these kind of distortions of perception. We're so used to identifying with outside phenomena, getting our kind of orientation in the world by looking outside and hearing sounds and familiar things. And if we actually change our perceptual references, sometimes we get these strange phenomena. I know when I was first practicing in Thailand and I was spending many hours watching the breath and not being aware of the body physically, had these very strange sensations. The body was floating and it was like a balloon and my arm was twice the size that it really was. Sometimes I had to open my eyes and check, you know. Maybe I got a glowing up or something. But if you just recognize them, again, just as they're just perceptual phenomena or mental phenomena, all kinds of strange things can arise and pass away. And don't take them too seriously. Don't get too concerned with them. They're just, as it were, just like when you're walking on a path somewhere. You don't need to be concerned with every single leaf on the ground and every single detail. You know, they're just all leaves. They're just perceptions. They're just phenomena. Then it gives you a little bit more of a objective perspective on them, and you can kind of divest your personal interest and personal fascination with them, and they may begin to fade away then. Otherwise, it may be, you know, a sign of something, you know, maybe a physical weakness. You know, sometime maybe if we aren't eating properly, our blood sugar level drops, and maybe we do have certain physical sensations arise. So if it persists, you better see a doctor. When breath meditation is being practiced, what can one do if meaningless pictures start appearing in the mind, fantasies? Yeah, I would say the first thing, maybe to open your eyes, to reconnect with reality. I mean, again, this is somewhat similar to the last one, you know, when we are changing our kind of frame of reference, internalizing our awareness to a internal object. Sometimes we have these kind of strange phenomena. You know, it can be maybe sometimes the mental phenomena are more empowered, but to try to reestablish connection with the body, with your environment, open the eyes, bring attention to the bodily sensations, to help us to get some perspective on it. Otherwise, it might be, you know, we can maybe get caught up with these fantasies, for example, and thinking that maybe we are, it's a sign of progress, or, you know, the celestial beings are talking to us or something. So, to go back to the body, back to trying to reconnect with the reality around us, the familiar reality. Please explain the Buddhist approach to blame and forgiveness. Well, blame, I guess, is two-sided. It could be being blamed or blaming others. And forgiveness, I mean, the most useful or valuable approach is just try to investigate the whole nature of this attitude that we have. It's a kind of a reaction to certain experiences we have. It may be a certain kind of a conditioned reflex. You know, if we have been receiving a lot of criticism, for example, maybe we need to defend ourselves by pushing it outside and blaming something outside. But in the long term, it's not a skillful attitude. Helpful to try, maybe to try and unpack it. As I mentioned, my experience, you know, what's triggering it off, what's conditioning it, what's stimulating it. Maybe it gives us a bit more perspective on the kind of cause and effect processes that are involved in it. The practice of forgiveness, I mean, this is a little bit related to the practice of metta or friendliness. It can be another way of approaching friendliness. If we have a little bit of a block trying to be friendly, maybe we have to go back and actually practice a bit more forgiveness first. Forgiving ourselves, forgiving other people, forgiving the situation. And sometimes we get locked into a particular conditioned relationship or a conditioned experience. And it's hard for us to see another way out, another perspective. But forgiveness is like learning to backtrack. Acknowledge mistakes. Acknowledge the complications in it. Trying to acknowledge our responsibility in it. And, you know, in forgiveness, there's also, you know, it's like there's an act of giving up too. Act of humility, act of surrender. You know, if we're too proud, it can be very hard for us to do that. Very hard for us to forgive. But I just say something like, you know, in any situation, you know, we're always involved in it too. It's not always somebody else's fault. It takes two to tango. It takes two to conflict. Yeah. So what we can do, maybe we can't solve the situation, the other person or the other situation. We can work with ourselves, though. And sometimes just learning to be a bit more humble, recognize our mistakes, stepping back, giving up, letting go, can be give us another whole perspective and relationship to these experiences. So I hope that was helpful. I mean, it's a bit of a general question, so a bit of a general answer, I think, too. But so, voila, finish. I'm sure it's not the end of questions, but one of Ajahn Chah's ways of relating to questions was to many times just ask people, you know, like, who's asking the question? Or asking us, you know, sometimes putting it back to us. If he experience was that if he saw somebody who was really struggling with a question and really having a little difficulty with it, he could give an answer. Sometimes quite directly. Other times if he saw somebody was a little bit more settled, they could contemplate, they could investigate, and they could work with it a bit more, he would put it back to us. He was a real master of never giving a straight answer. He was always encouraging us to go back and maybe reformulate and try and inquire into ourselves, who's asking the question? Or why am I asking that question? Sometimes you didn't actually want even an answer. You just wanted him to say that you're good, you know, or something or other. You wanted Big Daddy to say you're great, you know. And the value of that was that he encouraged people to learn to be their own teacher, not dependent upon always finding an answer outside. Yeah, and sometimes it wasn't very pleasant because you have to struggle with it. But the benefit is that you learn how to formulate these questions and go back to their origin. You know, why do I need to have an answer? And sometimes being able to work with it, I see, broadens out the whole issue and points back to the sources of these questions. And many times you don't even need an answer. I found that sometimes just when I was able to clearly formulate the question, the answer was already there. It was just my lack of being able to really, really look at what the real question was about, or where it's coming from, that I wanted somebody else to sort it out for me. A bit of lazy thinking, really. So this is another way of approaching it, that if we do really need some answers, of course, there's many possibilities for getting an answer, but sometimes it's more useful to work with it, lead us back to the questioner again. Maybe the questioner is more important to question than getting an answer. So that wasn't just a way to get out of answering questions, but... So I think I better pause there this evening because we still have the same program as yesterday, I think. 5 o'clock, waking up, and now that you're just getting into it, you know, it'll soon be over, so make use of the opportunity, and hopefully you'll have a good rest tonight, and be wide awake tomorrow, be even more awakened tomorrow.